This is Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our web address is libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org. Today we are talking with Randy Simmons about his revised and updated edition, Beyond Politics, The Roots of Government Failure. Professor Simmons is a professor of economics and director of the Institute of Political Economy at Utah State University's John Huntsman School of Business. He is also the former mayor of Providence, Utah, and he is a senior fellow at the Independent Institute and the Property Environment Research Center. He is the author of The Political Economy of Culture and Norms, Informal Solutions to the Commons Problem. He is also a contributing author to many volumes, but one book in particular, Rethinking Green, Alternatives to Environmental Bureaucracy. Randy, we're glad to have you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I want to ask you at the beginning, so your book is about public choice methodology and really bringing that into dispute and controverting welfare economics, which really provides a lot of the concepts and terms that help us think about the regulatory state, or that I should say justify the regulatory state and the vast administrative bureaucracies that regulate and control pretty much everything we do. And a lot of the terms that market failure, public goods, imperfect competition, imperfect information, justifying regulation come from welfare economics. So sketch for us, what is public choice and why should it be the baseline for our thinking about the workings of government?
I think it was George Stigler who said that he chided economists for identifying all of the supposed failures of markets and then assuming that government could fix them. He said it was like listening to two contestants in a singing contest, and after hearing the first one, just awarding her the. I think he said it. Listening to the two contestants, and after hearing the first one, she was so bad they just awarded the prize to the second one without even hearing that one sing. Humans are wonderfully imperfect. And our institutions are imperfect as well. Markets are that way, but our governments are even more imperfect. What the welfare economists did was they established this framework for analyzing how markets work. They compared market outcomes to what you would get if you had a perfectly functioning market inside of some mathematical model. And said, "Oh no, it doesn't work as perfectly as our models say that they should. That it should." And but then they didn't apply their analysis to government, and so they just assumed government could fix problems without ever analyzing government. And what public choice did was took the same tools that welfare economists use for looking at markets and applied them to government. And we end up with realizing that government failure is a huge problem. And government failure just covers a host of issues, but it's where it's government failing to produce the outcomes that it could. And I think we show them beyond politics that not only does government do less than produce less outcomes that are not as good as it ought to, but worse outcomes than it could if we actually restricted the scope of government.
So there's really an unfair comparison to begin with. There's some platonic or insistence on platonic protection for the market, but not for government. What is the substantive vision of welfare economics? Is it a regulatory, technical, perfectionist aim? Is there egalitarianism at heart? Is there a belief that the market itself is unjust, or that it's just too... it's too messy, things can't be predicted and controlled, we don't like that? I mean, what seems to be driving this thing philosophically?
Welfare economics just becomes a tool that can be used for by people with lots of different ideologies. One is sort of the just a positive look at markets and say, oh, they aren't perfect. But the next step is to take the normative step, which is to say, because they don't produce the equality that I would like in the world, we have to fix that. So you most of the arguments that you actually see about promoting equality, I think, are based out of welfare economics, even when people don't realize that that's where their basis is.
I was thinking, yeah, you mentioned government failure, of course, at the beginning. And, you know, just kind of thinking of the public reception, understanding of government failure. I mean, at one level, there seems to be a broad, you know, belief that government is inept. That it's certainly corrupt. There's a lot of corruption inside government, particularly amongst politicians. There's, I mean, regulatory capture, that seems, people may not use that term, but they seem to kind of understand that. And, you know, even if you're thinking about current trends, I mean, we don't see an overwhelming belief that the government's going to be able to, you know, efficiently administer Obamacare. At least I don't sense that. But yet there's also contradictory impulses, I think. In particular, you know, with Dodd-Frank and the Consumer Financial Products Bureau, I think, you know, if you were to throw out what the CFPB is doing, it's this monstrous bureaucracy created by Dodd-Frank to regulate credit, essentially, and how banks and a lot of institutions, theoretically every institution, how they operate and interact with applying credit, et cetera. People say, oh, that's a good thing. That'll protect people. We like that. Or, you know, even thinking of the oil spill, the massive oil spill of British Petroleum several years ago in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, there was no real discussion about, you know, the problems and the incentives that led to BP to be drilling a mile deep way offshore. There was just kind of an assumption that BP was bad and the government was needed to step in and fix it. So I guess I'm, you know, it seems, you know, we laugh now about the idea of the best and the brightest, yet at one time people really believed in that notion of smart people being in government fixing things. So, I mean, I'm curious to get your reaction on that. Where do you sense people are and recognize this problem of government failure?
You know, I spent 10 years in local city government. You know, I live in a town of under 7,000 people. I was on the city council for 6 years and mayor for 4 years. And I was always amazed at how people would come saying, there's this problem in my life, in my neighborhood, fix it for us. There ought to be a law, sort of knee-jerk reaction to things around them, instead of, you know, well, just for example, someone, you know, would come to me and say, my neighbor's dog is barking and it's bothering me. And my first response was always, well, have you talked to your neighbor? Oh, no, I couldn't do that. He might get upset at me, but you can go do it for me. Just something as simple as that, I think, illustrates why we so easily say, oh, the financial system had problems, let's fix it by more regulation. It's just sort of this automatic, let's not take personal responsibility for stuff we're doing, let's have government fix it. And as soon as you have a let's have government fix it attitude, then it's easy to get to something like Dodd-Frank, which, you know, if I do a third edition of the book, there will have to be a financial institutions chapter.
Yes.
Because my understanding of Dodd-Frank is that Dodd-Frank really helps the really big banks. As you might have, as a public choice analyst would have predicted, it had very little to do with actually improving credit, but a whole bunch to do with restricting competition and protecting the position of those who are really good at lobbying.
I was going to talk with you briefly about some other concepts in public choice and thinking about current regulations, but I think we should also spend time and talk about the great economist James Buchanan, who was a pioneer in this field and who passed away yesterday. And I know that this is someone who's meant a lot to you, so I was just going to ask you to talk about him and his life and work in this regard.
Yeah, my undergraduate degree was in political science, just a behavioral standard political science degree. I knew nothing about economics. I had taken one economics course and gotten a C in it. I thought it was terrible. I went to graduate school in political science, and the very first book I read was a book that had just come out by Jim Buchanan, a collection of his essays called Freedom and Constitutional Contract. And it was, you hear about a light coming on. Well, that's how it felt like. I suddenly saw the world through an entirely different lens than I had ever thought of before. And Buchanan's book was, for me, the most important thing I read in graduate school. It was the most important direction-giving set of essays that I had read, and it was, I didn't read the more famous book, The Calculus of Consent, that he wrote with Tulloch for years, but I didn't read it until years later, but he had a huge impact on my thinking about how the world worked. And what he did, along with Gordon Tulloch, is they started a research agenda about how governments work and thinking about government as being able to look at government through the lens of economics. Specifically, they were looking at issues of Buchanan's real interest was looking at issues of exchange, thinking of politics as a system of exchange, just as markets are a system of exchange. But then you start seeing all of the issues that flow through government. He once was asked, I believe, if public choice was a conservative agenda, and he said he didn't think it was. He thought it was just an agenda of looking at taking a non-romantic view of how government works. Thinking about my own career and that of many other people I know, there's probably nobody who had a bigger effect than Buchanan, and I think on an entire profession. He just he and Tulloch took ideas that were floating around before they started to write together, and then as they wrote individually also, and coalesced them into something that was a very wonderful, I think, project. When they first started meeting with other people and who had similar agendas, they put together a book of essays on the theory of non-market. He later said it was such a clumsy title that we had to figure out something else. Theory of non-market decision making, I think,
yes,
is what it
yes,
was.
Yes, I was trying to. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is really clumsy, isn't it? And there was a group of them who met to read and talk about each other's papers, and they came. And it was out of that group that they came up with the name public choice. Private choice. Economics is the study of private choices, and public choice is the study of public choices. And people who were around that table, Bill Riker, Eleanor and Vincent Ostrom, Buchanan and Tulloch, probably Bob Tallis and a few others, Bill Mitchell, who was my mentor in graduate school and for much of the rest of my career, he and I wrote the first edition of Beyond Politics together. I think Bill was the one who came up with the name Public Choice, but that small group of people who then sort of went out and populated academia in ways that really changed the face, I think, of a profession. Political scientists looked at it as sort of an economic imperialism, economists showing up in their territory, and many political scientists still object to it, but it really has, I think, permeated even political science, not just economics.
Certainly, I think Buchanan's work, at least what I've read, and I don't really focus on, is thinking about, I'll say, constitutionalism and constitutions and contracts. He's actually, in many ways, making explicit what was implicit in the political science of certainly key founders, key framers of our constitutional order, and I think that's tremendously beneficial, and to remind people why we have this compound government, why we have federalism, separation of powers, why they insisted on the rule of law, supermajority provisions, and all of that had been kind of forgotten in the mau-mau of democratic centralism that's really pervaded our government in the 20th century. I want to move to perhaps another famous economist, Vernon Smith. You lead off your book with a Wall Street Journal article from some years ago in which they ask several Nobel economists this question, quote, in what sphere of life, if any, do you think it most important to limit the influence of market forces? And they all respond with some version of, well, this, this, and this, and this, and it's quite substantive how the government needs to respond. But here's Vernon Smith's quote, answer to this question. What sphere? None. Because markets are about recognizing that information is dispersed in all social systems, and that the problem of society is to find, devise, and discover institutions that incentivize and enable people to make the right decisions without anyone having to tell them what to do. The idea that market forces should be limited stems from fundamental error. This is the wrong question. And I want to unpack that, particularly this idea of information and localized information and knowledge, which is certainly at the heart of what you do as a public choice thinker, along with other, we might even say it's a pillar, I would think. This information, localized knowledge, but in light of also a belief that with the digital revolution, we can handle a lot of information well. We can disperse it, we can allocate it, analyze it, and apply it and make people's lives better. I mean, this seems to be part of actually Obamacare, in particular, one significant piece of that, which is the Independent Payments Advisory Board, which has received a lot of attention because of there seems to be really no check on what they do, at least from Congress. They're an independent board and can make decisions about procedures, the costs, what will be reimbursed, what will be offered to seniors. And this is actually going to hold healthcare costs down because they're going to aggregate knowledge all over the country. So where are we going wrong? Am I right? Are we just too confident about information? Do we need to really think more about this problem that Vernon Smith was identifying?
We're back to the socialist calculation debate of the 30s, where the assumption was that we could get good enough at managing information that we would know how to run markets. And if we go back to that quote from Vernon, it's running people's lives, because he says you want systems where people do what they ought to do without anybody telling them to. And here, this is an assumption that we can gather enough information and then tell people what they must do. So it really is back to that same debate that Hayek was having with the socialists in the 30s. But I was reading yesterday in Tyler Cowen and Alex Tabarrok's macro textbook, which is now in its second edition, and they had a question at the end of the chapter about if you had 1 million people and there were 1 million things to know, and if you provide that information for all 1 million people, or you provide a third of it to divide that population into thirds, and provide them different pieces, which would be the more vital system. And the idea that you take 1 million people and they know 1 million things, that may be great, but if you divide that information among lots of people, then what happens is that you get this sort of explosion of ideas and of information that comes because you have all these different minds working in different areas, not just the same area. And I think that's one of the problems with the Obamacare, is that the assumption that you can, that, well, one of the problems is you try and centralize knowledge, you're going to reduce the knowledge that you have. Because, you know, even with our modern computer systems and big data analysis, you have to decide somebody has to decide what information you drop along the way in order to come to conclusions. And as soon as you start putting it into a computer program, then there are things that get systematically dropped. And we end up, but if you allow individual people out there making their choices in a system where they can, where they're actually responsible for their choices, you're going to get new information that none of us can actually anticipate in any way. And that's the problem, is that the assumption is that with Obamacare, we can anticipate solutions. Now, I'm not saying that our healthcare system works even close to perfect, because it is such a mishmash system. But even so, I think that if you allow markets to work in that system, you'll have far more information, far better choices than we will if we try and centralize. Because as soon as you centralize, even with big data, you're going to lose important information, and draw and simplify in ways that just don't reflect reality.
It's interesting to think too. I mean, one basic problem of our healthcare system is our pricing data is not exactly reflective of consumer choice. One reason why is the third party payer problem. The majority of Americans still get their healthcare from their employer. And of course, there's this, I'm not actually making decisions with my own money. Health savings accounts are an attempt to get at that. But Obamacare does nothing about this problem. It seems to be an interesting comparison. I don't know, I was just thinking of Walmart and how many prices they have to set every day. It's a huge number. But of course, what are they relying on to set their prices? What would healthcare under Obamacare rely on to set prices are two very, very different things, as you could discuss. I wanted to think also about this idea of just trade-offs and people saying, I'm willing to trade economic growth or even, think about all of these sectors, the financial sector, the healthcare sector, entrepreneurial vitality for some sort of stability, for some sort of democratic baseline of services that would be offered if the government regulates it. How does public choice respond to those sorts of claims?
With a huge amount of skepticism about the abilities of government agents to actually accomplish what they set out to do, not because of waste, fraud, and abuse. We know that will be there, but it's not a waste, fraud, and abuse analysis. It's an analysis of incentives within institutions and information flows within institutions. As a bureaucrat, when I make a decision, there aren't feedback systems that tell me if that was a good decision or a bad decision. At Walmart, they put a price on something, and the feedback mechanism is, do people buy it? And how many people buy it at that price? Or when they put something on the shelves, is it something that people actually buy, even if it's a very low price? And some things people just don't want. But if you're a bureaucrat, you don't need to know that. You just can establish rules, and you don't ever get the feedback to know if it's a good thing or how well it works necessarily, at least not the way that you do in markets. So it's an information and incentive problem that's what a public choice analysis would look at with that.
I'm thinking of, obviously a huge part of what you've done with your research and other public choice scholars do is really set forth a positive empirical case for government not being able to regulate well in a lot of areas. How does that inform normative arguments what are ends and purposes of government regulation or of things that we should place beyond politics? And also alternatively, I'll ask you, so what can politics do? What do we actually want the government doing? And how should we think about those sorts of questions?
If you look at purposes the American founders thought about, those are the same purposes that I think we still have today. You want a system of providing for the common defense. Buchanan was asked if he was an anarchist, and in the introduction to Freedom and Constitutional Contract, he said, philosophically, I'm an anarchist. Realistically, I'm a contractarian. because my ideal world, I don't think, would last very long, the world of anarchy. Now, there's some really cool anarchy theories that are around that he just rejected and said humans are too imperfect. We couldn't live in the Robert Nozickian world. We have to have some form of contract, and his form of contract is you provide for the common defense. You provide a way for people to ways to enforce contracts, a system of law and order, and not necessarily much beyond that. But notice that you mentioned positive and normative. Anything beyond that becomes sort of normative position, saying, there are many people argue that you have to have governments to provide a monetary system. The data don't show that that's necessarily correct. But that's a standard assumption. Providing public goods and controlling negative externalities is generally viewed as a useful purpose of government. But if we look at things like at the environment and the understandings we've now gotten from free market environmentalism, that argument doesn't push very far positively. It pushes a long ways normatively by people who believe that we need to be controlling other people's uses of the natural world around us. Actually, let me say the world around us, because who knows what natural means.
Yeah, I was thinking of, you talk a lot in the book, in the section on law, about Ronald Coase's work. And I think kind of this, everyone understands, I think there's a general belief, although I guess there's a lot of polling data that's disconcerting about, people preferring socialism or thinking socialism, they don't say work, but they think it's, just, et cetera, which is it's really strange to me. But thinking about this idea that there's just a lot of places that markets don't work, one of them being the environment. Other areas, healthcare is another we've been discussing, maybe even finance. And I don't think about Coase's idea of property rights, which is, we've talked about prices, we've talked about information dispersal and needing to act on local knowledge. But there's this other thing out there of property rights and transaction costs that really don't factor into people's common way of thinking, but is about government and its inefficiencies. But Coase emphasizes it was a revolution in thinking. And but I'm also curious to know, how do you get around the transaction cost problem? Because that seems to be something that still looms large and in favor of government regulation.
The welfare economics argument is that there are these market failures. And one of the biggest market failures is externalities, the costs that I create for others by my actions, and the costs that I don't have to pay for. And that is really standard analysis. It's taught in every undergraduate and graduate program. And Coase said that's just wrong, that any externality problem is a problem of property rights. Should A be allowed to harm B, or B be allowed to harm A? What are the property rights arrangements between them? One of my favorite examples from my time as mayor was my city starts in the valley floor and then goes up to the sort of the foot of the mountains, and as you approach the foot of the mountains, it just gets higher, it's a bench. And the reason for that is because there was once this huge inland sea here, and the benches are different levels of the shoreline.
This is in northwestern Utah?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So this woman lived off the bench, off of both levels of benches, actually. And there was a proposed development up on the bench, and she was upset that traffic would be coming down past her street. And she said, she always prefaced her comments in city council meeting with, I'm a PhD economist. And this is a perfect example of you imposing a negative externality on me. And I said to her, so have you ever heard of Ronald Coase? He would suggest that externalities are two-way, that if you weren't there, there would be no externality, right? So do you actually own the road? Maybe you're the one causing the externality for the people who want to build a new home. She didn't like that. Of course, she hadn't voted for me, I know, so I wasn't losing a vote.
And every vote counts, right?
Yeah, but the idea that it's unclear who truly has the right in that case, because she didn't own the road. And if she owned the road, there wouldn't be any externality, because if people who wanted to use her road would have to pay her for it, or she could exclude them from it. Now then the question is, how do you develop a road system that's entirely a private property system? Gordon Tullock once said he's never seen the libertarian case for city roads, and he may be right about that, But that gets back to your question about the transaction costs. How do you get negotiations between all of the people who want to build up on the bench and all the people who already live down in town when you don't have clear property rights? And Kosa's point was, it's the transaction costs that we should be looking at, and that if there is a role for government, it's to be reducing the transaction costs. The role for government is not necessarily to be controlling the externalities, it's to make it possible for people to actually negotiate the solutions to their problems. And Terry Anderson at PERC, the Property Environment Research Center, argues that there are no externalities, that externalities is a word that just leads us in incorrect directions. But what we have, because we have unclear property rights, then what we have is this arena where entrepreneurs could try and find ways, if government allows it, could find ways of allowing for the
to solve
the problems, to create new institutions for solving the problems, like in the the case of say in Montana, where you have these huge rangeland areas that are privately owned, and elk come down in the winter and then go back up in the mountains in the summer, and it's how do we solve the problems there? And the problems that have been solved for preserving that elk habitat is these it's private institutions that have come in and created these long-standing easements, essentially for elk, and they've paid the ranchers to be able to have the elk there. It's just it's a very odd and interesting system that you would never have thought of if you'd just done a market analysis problem and say, oh, these ranchers are destroying elk habitat. Yeah, they own it, but they're not allowing the elk to come down there. Instead of recognizing there's a room for a political entrepreneur to come in and create new institutions. That's a long-winded and not necessarily very clear answer to your question, but if you create an arena where somebody can figure out a way to bring the parties together in ways that none of us have ever thought of, then we can have solutions to problems.
It seems to me interesting, because I've been thinking, and it seems to me it's still in the early stages, but with the advent of health savings accounts, when the first introduction of giving a lot of people a lot of consumer choice in healthcare, you are seeing hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers and doctors put forward their pricing data on their website, or contribute to clearinghouse websites where you can go get pricing data and see the absurdity of this pricing problem. It seems to me that continues to develop if we allow, or if we were to move in that direction for healthcare. It won't if we really do institutionalize Obamacare and really develop that legislation. Of course, there's so many other problems that will make it difficult to implement Obamacare. But also, as I was listening to you talk, so something that goes on every few years are we up the CAFE standards, we up the emissions requirements for automobile makers, and less and less emissions, and there are all sorts of problems that are created by that. Although, and it does make the air cleaner. That is one thing. Think about the transaction cost there. And applying what you are saying, we should actually incentivize companies to reduce emission standards in other ways besides just a tax or a command control regulation. How would you handle that, or how do you think would be a good way to handle that?
Well, CAFE standards are a really inefficient way of reducing air pollution. Yes. For one thing, you're telling somebody in North Dakota that their car has to have the same standards as a car in Southern California, where there are. So one place you don't have enough population to cause any problems at all, and the other place you have lots of people with their automobiles producing stuff out of their producing emissions that then coalesce with other emissions, and you get all the chemical reactions, and you end up with smog problems. And so just increasing emission standards don't do anything about people's driving habits. It doesn't affect, It's a very, very costly way to achieve sort of small increments in improvements. A much more efficient way than that is simply, I've just been writing about carbon taxes, and I'm in general very suspicious of them. But a much more efficient system would be a tax on gasoline, and you would get far better improvements. You would actually get demand for vehicles that have higher mileage standards if gasoline were more expensive, and it would be far less expensive to the economy, to people individually, to have a system like that where it actually affected individual choices than a system that of regulation. Regulations are, they don't affect choices in the way that prices do. And so it's possible to make arguments that if you have externalities where people just cannot come together in any meaningful way, that a role for government is to figure out a way to get prices more closely to where they would be, where they ought to be to solve the problem. And I hate to be arguing for taxes, but this is one case where a tax would be far, far better than the system that we have adopted.
Yeah, I mean, I think, right, as one goal is efficiency and allowing wealth to grow, allowing people to create wealth in the products and services they provide. So, yeah, I understand your point. I want to, maybe we can end on a hopeful note, and I just wanted to get your thoughts. So, promising reforms, and of course, this is such a vast area. I mean, so many different parts of our lives are regulated and come under what we call the regulatory state. But I was just thinking through. So, two things pending right now. One is enforcing a cost-benefit analysis on courts. Some people were writing about this, that the federal courts would actually have to apply a cost-benefit analysis test against bureaucracies when they propose rules. That would be something that in a court's toolkit. And then also requiring rules that have a significant cost to the economy to actually be passed by both the House and the Senate. And also, I was just going to ask you, three books, or maybe, one or two or three, I don't know, that really help us understand the problems we've been discussing today. If you could leave us with some recommendations, I think that'd be good.
Ask me that again. Are you saying three? Did you say three books?
Well, I don't know. I was just thinking of some ways, some things that help people get a handle on thinking about the regulatory state. I didn't know if there's anything you had read recently that you could recommend. So I was just curious.
Michael Greva has a recent book about
He's one of the bloggers at Law and Liberty, the Upside Down Constitution. Yeah, applying James Buchanan's work to thinking about the Constitution. Yeah, it's wonderful.
His work is some of the best around, I think, on that topic. If you're looking for a completely satirical view, but actually has really deep insights, anything that P.J. O'Rourke has written is for students to read P.J. O'Rourke something as old as The Parliament of Horrors is a good way of stepping back and saying, oh, let's think more seriously about how things get organized, looking at welfare, for example. What else that's recent? Terry Anderson and Don Leo have just—they have the newest edition of Free Market Environmentalism, which I think is a really hopeful view of how we might have environmental protection, but have it done. And going back to the Vernon Smith quote about where you have institutions that actually encourage people to do the right thing as opposed to try and tell them what the right thing is. So those are a couple, I think, quite good examples.
Okay. So, and just thinking going forward, what are promising reform ideas or efforts that you see out there for dealing with?
Well, any effort to try and get courts to actually have to recognize the cost of their decisions, yes, I think, is a really important thing. For example, in the Endangered Species Act, the legislation specifically prohibits the court from considering economic any economic considerations. Okay. You're only looking at the particular species. So if in order to...
So that's why we get these absurd situations of the snail darter and, you know, millions of acres being, you know, can no longer be farmed or made productive, et cetera.
Yeah, you look at southern Utah, for example. You have the Utah prairie dog that's protected, and they have whole cemeteries and golf courses that can't be used because you've got prairie dogs in them. We could spend a long time talking about that, but, you know, the court cannot look at economic considerations for that. So if courts were required to look at economic considerations, of course you get lots of competing arguments about them, but at least you could have the arguments.
Yes.
And I really am in favor of legislative bodies having to approve regulatory decisions. You know, once the legislative body says, here's the law, let's create this new law that does X. Well, it can't do X unless you have a whole bunch of regulations that put X into place. And it's the design of those regulations that really are going to create costs. And so I would think if you sent back to those legislators the results of their legislation, first of all, you would have a better analysis of the effects. Secondly, you might actually get legislators to recognize the costs that they do create for people, often unintentionally.
Yeah, I know that. I keep thinking about, so what are the types of arguments you could see, you know, getting into the battle of dollars and how you weigh an economic regulation. Seems to me that's even to bring that conversation forward and make it public and make it part of deliberation, the way we think about the regulatory state. Would be a positive thing, I would think. We can end. I will mention the book is Beyond Politics, The Roots of Government Failure. Randy, I've really enjoyed talking with you about your work and public choice theory and understanding more about how to think about this problem of the regulatory state. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
This is your host, Richard Reinch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, and find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org.